You are in for a treat tonight. Janet Crawford, who is our speaker, originally spoke to us. I was trying to remember the exact year, but I think it was something like 93 or somewhere in that range, just a few years after our organization was started. She is a critical care nurse, currently teaching at the School of Nursing here at the University of Utah as an adjunct professor. I remember as she told of experiences that she had, hearing near-death experiences and similar kinds of experiences from people to whom she was giving care as a lifelight nurse and in the hospital, that these were some of the most amazing things that I had ever heard. We always thought it'd be great to have her come back and speak again, but unbeknownst to us, she had moved out of state. She has spent time in Florida, and I don't remember where all, but I'm sure she can tell you a little bit about that, but at a number of different hospitals and different places. Since she was last here, I'm sure her list of experiences that she has encountered has vastly increased. So you're in for a real treat tonight. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you Janet Crawford as our speaker tonight. Please give her a round of applause. Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be back after 22 years. I think I was your flight nurse, wasn't I? If I remember back when we were comparing notes, I flew you because I could remember your whole story. I was your flight nurse. But I've been in critical care since 1978. I've been a nurse practitioner since 1982. I flew in helicopters for 15 years. I've run helicopter programs. I've run emergency rooms and trauma centers. I still work full-time as a nurse practitioner in care centers now. Just started that a couple months ago. And I work part-time as adjunct faculty for the doctoral program at the University of Utah. I think in all my years, which are many now, my gray hair attests to that, that I've heard well over at least 1,500 to 1,600 near-death experiences from my patients. I stopped listing them. I stopped recording them. It was too much. But there is some common themes we'll talk about later. And I'm sure a lot of us have had our own NDEs, and we could go on and on and on about our own personal NDEs. Yes, I have had my own, but that's not what I'm going to talk about tonight. Tonight I'm going to talk about my patients and some of the more interesting ones that I had, and I'm going to focus on mostly, well, part of them are the children that I've heard from kids. So a lot of people ask me, how did I start with this? Well, when I was young, I read Life Everlasting, and my mother ripped it out of my hands and said, stop it, it's satanic, don't do that. So I stayed away from it until this event happened to me. I was about 23, 24 years of age, and I was working down at Utah Valley Hospital, and I was the charge nurse in the ICU, CCU area. I was the poor night shift, okay? Yeah, I was the grave digger. I went in to relieve for some lunches, and I had gotten report on these patients, and I'd hunkered down, you know, to watch the cardiac monitors. And this is before stents, before clot buster drugs. When you had a heart attack, you just had a heart attack. And if you lived, bonus for you, and if you died, oh well, so sorry. So this lady had had a cardiac arrest at home. She was resuscitated by the paramedics, brought into the coronary care unit. I sit down and I'm watching my monitors, and I see this lady waving at me. Come here. And I'm thinking, oh great, another crazy. And then I thought, no, Janet, come on. Maybe she needs a drink. Or maybe she's having chest pain again. Suck it up, go see what she wants. So I walked over to her, no problem, braced for the worst. And she said, pull that curtain and sit down. Get a chair over here and sit down. Pull the curtain. And I'm thinking, oh, it's the crazy. You just have to humor them at times. So I pulled the chair over, and she looked deep in my eyes, and she said, I don't want you to be shocked, but I have to tell you something. You. I have to tell you something. She said, I was shown you. I've seen you working, and I need to tell you what happened to me. I don't know why I have to tell you what happened to me, but I do. So don't say anything, just listen to what I have to say. And then she said, this is the whole reason I came back, is to tell you this. And as soon as I'm done, I get to go back home. So don't bother me. Don't interrupt. I'm still thinking anoxic brain injury. Crazy. Okay. She got all over me. She got angry at me because she'd waited 3 days for me to show my face. 3 days. She had been a patient in the CCU for 3 days. And she was angry that it took me 3 days for me to come in so she could deliver this message and go home. She was not happy with me. Now I'm ready to listen. Yeah, the goosebumps are going down big time. The hair is coming up the back of the neck. You know the feeling. But I'm braced. Okay, lay it on me. So then she told me that when she had had the heart attack, the chest pain, she left her body and looked down and watched the paramedics work on her. And she was extremely accurate in what she said to me that the paramedics did. She didn't miss a beat. She was right on target. She said she had grown bored, which I can relate to. She grew bored, and she decided not to watch anymore, and she went up a tunnel. And then she said that she had had a similar experience a couple years before, and so she knew exactly what to do. And so I had researched this, and sure enough, she had arrested 3 years before. So she said she knew exactly what to do when she saw the tunnel. The tunnel she described as being misty, kind of grayish, with a bright light at the very end. And she knew she needed to get right up to that light. As soon as she got through the light, she was home free. So that's what she did. As soon as she popped out of the light, she was in a beautiful, beautiful garden with a gorgeous stone bench. She said many of her deceased family members were there with her. She described to me her intense feelings of love, peace, happiness, joy. And she said, and best of all, the pain from my heart attack was gone. There was no pain. I was pain-free. She then walked down the path in the garden, was met by a man that she labeled Jesus Christ. He asked her a question, and this is the question, and she wanted me to memorize this. How have you loved your fellow man? And she said for the second time in her life, her whole life rolled in front of her eyes. She saw every last action, thought, feeling that she had ever experienced or that she had caused someone else to experience. After this review, she was taken back to her family, and someone, she doesn't know who, someone told her that she had to come back. She could not stay. At this point, she was shown an ICU unit. She was shown me working on a patient. She was able to see my face, my actions, my hairstyle, my makeup, the tone in my voice, and my compassionate disposition. She said it was very up close and personal. Gave me the heebie-jeebies. She was told that she needed to come back and wait for me to enter the ICU. And after I had entered, she was to relay to me her experience. And then she could come home. So after she was done, she looked at me, she says, and thank you for finally coming in. She did die 2 days later. So part of my nurse practitioner experience, I worked with, like I said, ICU patients, a lot of cardiology patients. So this is an experience by Mr. Chamberlain, and I actually asked Mr. Chamberlain if he would write it up in his own words. And so I'm going to read to you his own words that he relayed to me. Yes, I did resuscitate him in the ICU, and yes, I cared for him his whole hospital stay. So this is what he says. I was hospitalized to undergo an outpatient inguinal hernia operation. Everybody know where the inguinal hernia is? Your groin, right? He said, the first remembrance after my surgery is I felt myself actually coming out of my body. I saw a team of doctors and nurses working on me. As my spirit left my body, I saw two guardian angels, and they informed me that there had been some miscalculation and a slight problem. But the doctors would eventually get it worked out, at which time I would need to return to my body, because I had a mission that I had yet to complete on this plane. And they always referred to the earth as this plane. But they said, for now, I could go with them. He said, I remember leaving with my escorts. And he said, I must say at this time, I have never felt so contented, so alive, so relaxed, and so at peace in my life. We entered what I thought was a tunnel. It was very dark and black at first. You could see lights flickering up the tunnel. I was told by my escort that these lights were prayers from people on this plane traveling up to our Heavenly Father. I must say that the word earth was never mentioned, but it was always called this plane. I wasn't the only one in the tunnel. It seemed like my escorts were talking 100 miles a minute, but I understood absolutely everything that they were saying. I asked them about my religion, wanting to know how God felt about it. He was Southern Baptist. They explained that many different religions are made complicated. I was told that anyone could start a religion, but you must always look at the end result and see what fruits they bear. I was told that whether we call God by one name or another, we're all praying to the same supreme being. As we reached the end of the tunnel, I could see a very bright light shining. The light was so bright you would have thought it would blind the human eye, but it was just the opposite. There was a man there. It was Jesus Christ. When I received a huge hug from him, I felt so humble and wondered, how was I chosen for such a trip? He told me at this time that I would be going back to the plane I'd come from and that I had a mission that had not been completed. He then told me what the mission was, but for the life of me, I cannot remember what it was. We've all experienced that, haven't we? After discussing this, he told me I was to go with the escorts for a brief tour of heaven while the doctors worked on me. My first stop was a beautiful building. The architecture was just breathtaking. Before I reached the building, he's going backwards now, I remember seeing a very dark place where you heard a lot of awful moans, groans, and screams. I was told by my escorts that this is the devil's place or purgatory. My escorts went on to tell me that God had many angels of different types. He went on to say that God's archangels were taken at birth and are the purest of all his angels. They're the ones that intercept the prayers for him. Then the escorts told me about God's warring angels, and these are the ones that guarded that purgatory. Now, back to that first building, because it was good. We entered the building, and the music was absolutely breathtaking. And for those of you who had NDEs, you know what I'm talking about. There was also large weaving machines with men running them, and the material that they were weaving was beyond beautiful and extremely hard to describe. When we left the building, I could see at a distance my mother, my brother Carl, who had been in a wheelchair all of his life, but was walking, and my sister, who had died the year that I was born. How I recognized my sister, I don't know, but I even knew her name. They were all happy and well, but this was not my time to stay. They were looking forward to the time that we could all be together again. After this, we entered a valley. It was also so beautiful. The grass, the flowers, and the trees all looked so alive and so breathtaking. Now, my escorts told me that my tour was up and I must return to my body. How I hated going back. Some of you know what that feels like, don't you? But I knew that I must. When I got to the room where I left my body, there was a team of doctors working on me. I heard them saying that I had died, but I wanted to scream at them, "No, I'm alive, see?" I remember being told by my escorts that I was going to be in better health now than I was before my experience. I then entered my body and remember them telling my wife that all of a sudden, suddenly, now I was alive again. Back when I flew helicopter, I got to fly a lot of very interesting things, like Bill here. Kyle was 16 years old. Kyle and his four friends had decided to Slough High School. Bear Lake was pretty close, and it was really tempting and alluring, so their four friends hopped in the car, Slough School, and took off to Bear Lake. They spent the day swimming and goofing off, but they had to be back by the end of school, so that nobody knew that they had sloughed, especially their parents, right? If you've ever been from Barrel Lake going up the mountain toward Logan, you know how hairpinned and steep those roads are, right? Well, there were young drivers and going way too fast and swung way too wide and hit a one-ton pickup that were hauling six horses sort of head-on. Kyle was able to get out of the car and stagger to the side of the road where he collapsed. So he landed the helicopter there on the road. I jumped out and we started working on Kyle. Kyle was laying in the dirt, in the ditch. He was confused, combative, very hypotensive, meaning his blood pressure was very, very low. His heart rate was very, very fast. And he was complaining that he couldn't breathe. So I suspected he had a head injury, fractured thoracic back, he had a collapsed lung, and he obviously had an acute abdomen that was going to need extremely urgent surgery. It was pretty obvious. But I needed to throw in a chest tube to re-expand his lung so that when we went up in the helicopter, I wouldn't have really bad stuff happen. So I got ready to intubate, which is the breathing tube, right? So I got ready to intubate this kid. And I'm on the radio with the trauma center. And this really arrogant resident said, "Oh, you can't intubate him. Only I can intubate him. You are not to do it." I was so angry. But anyway, I went to put the chest tube in, and I listened one more time, and I could hear bowel tones in the chest, which is bad, bad, bad news, which means his diaphragm was ruptured, and all of his bowels was up in the chest, and that's what had collapsed his lung. Now, had I put a chest tube in, I would have gone straight through all of his bowels. That wouldn't have been so good either. So I thought, okay, let's just load and go. So we loaded him, and we took off, and we were going down the west side of the Wasatch Range. Well, as soon as we got to altitude, of course, Murphy's Law, he stops breathing, he arrests. So I had to intubate him in the helicopter, and that can be a little bit dicey and a little bit challenging. We practice for it all the time, but it's still more difficult than if you were doing it on the ground, on the ditch and the side of the road. I did scream at him at the top of my lungs. Now, the rotor sound is very, very loud, so I'm screaming trying to overcome the rotor noise, right? And I was screaming, "Damn it, Kyle, don't you leave me. Breathe, damn it, breathe." Of course, he wasn't breathing. It made me feel better, though. So we got him intubated, and I was able to stabilize him enough to get him to the trauma center. He spent 6 weeks in the shock trauma ICU trying to die, many, many of those days. He had multiple chest, abdominal, spine, and hip surgeries, developed septic shock, and he had the worst case of ARDS lung injury I've ever seen in my career. He coded many times. And so during all this time he was trying to survive, I spent time with his parents. And I told him, "Gee, if he ever survives this and wakes up, he might start talking to you about some weird dreams. Go with it. Just go with it." Luckily, I did, because when Kyle was actually awake and came off the ventilator, he started telling him about his weird dreams and his experiences. And the parents, the way I had trained them to react, which was not with horrendous surprise, but just love and tell me all about it, Kyle. 6 months later, I got a call from his mom who said that he really wanted to meet with me and talk about flight and what had happened to him. We met in the cafeteria after one of my flight shifts. So I'm talking to his mother, my back is to the door, and all of a sudden all I hear is, "Oh my gosh, it's you!" And it was Kyle, and he recognized the back of my head before it was gray. So we spent the next hour, and he told me this. This is what he told me. He said that when he stopped breathing, he left his body, and he stayed on the roof of the helicopter, which is how he saw the back of my head so close, because he was hovering over me as I was screaming at him, and he told me exactly what I'd screamed at him. Exactly. It was kind of embarrassing. He told me that he had no longer had any pain. He felt so alive and free and exhilarated. He was just so excited. He related to me exactly what I had screamed at him. He told me that he actually could hear my thoughts. And he says, "I heard how scared, fearful, and how bad you were worrying about me." He said he heard how frustrated and angry I was at that trauma doctor who said only he could intubate. He described the procedure that I did to him of intubation. Perfect. Without any mess of his detail, he got it. He nailed it. And then he said that he realized that he had two people waiting for him. So they flew off out of the helicopter and flew down Trees West Side. And he described to me the true color of trees, flowers, the sky. He said, "Do you know the sky is blue?" He says, "Not the blue you see. It's really blue." He said the sky was alive and had feelings. He said that the flowers and the trees, he said he could see and feel their life force, and they talked to him. He then described the tremendous sense of peace and contentment and fun that he was having as he was flying all around those pine trees and stuff on the backside of the Wasatch. He was then told by his guides that he was going to have to go back with one caveat. be sure and tell Janet your experience. And he woke up in ICU 6, almost 7 weeks later. So when he was well enough, he told me his experience as he had been instructed. And that was Kyle. Bradley is a beautiful 31-year-old now who's married and has 5 gorgeous kids. Still lives in rural Wyoming. Why, I'll never know. Bradley was 6, and he lived on a rural ranch out in the middle, and I swear to you, nowhere Wyoming. And he was a bored little 6-year-old. And he decided it would be really, really cool if he siphoned some gas out of the tractor. He found a soda can, and he filled it up with the gas from the tractor, and he lit it on fire because it was going to be really, really cool to kick it and watch it flaming as it flew across the sky, right? I mean, he did it all, so he kicked it. Problem is all that flaming on fire gas saturated him, and he ran into his house a flaming ball of fire. His mother, he was screaming, got a quilt and wrapped him up in a quilt to put out the flame, and then realized he was burnt really, really bad. She threw him in the car, and it was an hour to the closest doctor's office, let alone hospital. So she drove the hour to the local GP, and this is when they used to have GPs. The poor dude was 70 years old. Bless his heart. It's probably his last patient. He probably couldn't take any more after Bradley. All right, due to the thunderstorms, we could not fly close to him. So we told the doc, throw him in the back of an ambulance, drive like a bat out of you know where, and start south, and we're going to fly as fast as we can to where we can land, and we'll rendezvous with you. So that's what we did. An hour and a half later, we were landing in this little teeny strip. They unlocked the one-room emergency room for us, and I prepared. I had 10 minutes to prepare for Bradley before he would arrive in the ambulance. When they rolled in on the gurney, Brad was sitting straight up. He was having such difficulty breathing. His eyes were that deer in the headlight bulge out look, like, oh my gosh, look, you know what I'm saying? His heart rate was 220 beats a minute, I noticed, on the monitor as he walked by. They couldn't get an IV, he was too burned. They couldn't get any pulses. They couldn't get a blood pressure. But little Bradley was still wide awake and scared out of his brains. So I thanked the very nice 70-year-old GP, sent him on his way. I looked at my paramedic with that, oh my gosh, look. I knew we were in really, really big trouble, like really, really big trouble. And I knew that as soon as I started working on Brad, he most likely was going to code. And I didn't think I was going to get him back. So I went out to his mom, who was in the waiting room, and I said, look, Bradley's burned really, really, really bad. I need to put him to sleep, and he's going to rest. And I don't think I'm going to save him. I need you to go in and say goodbye to him before I put him to sleep. And I need you to be strong. So she did. God bless her soul. And she to this day tells me how hard that was. She walked into Bradley, hugged what she could, told him how much she loved him, and said goodbye to him. So I laid everything out, got everything ready, and I put him to sleep to put the breathing tube down. And sure enough, there goes his heart, and he coded, just like we knew he would. But we were ready for it. We were ready. So we were able to get the tube down the airway. I had to put in a central line. I don't know if any of you know what that is, you know, big central lines. I put in an arterial line to get a blood pressure. We coded that poor child for almost 2 straight hours. I had to do what's called escharotomies, or cut the burn skins all over the chest, the arms, the legs, everything to try and get pulses. I tell you, I've never worked on a child so hard for so long in my life. His heart would stop, and we'd get it going, and he would stop, and we would get it going, and we coded and coded and coded this kid. You know, back in the day, I could really swear. I mean, sailors would be proud of me. And I swore a lot in my head, and I muttered a lot of swear words under my breath, and my paramedic was muttering just as bad as I was, because it was a tense situation. After about 2 hours, we were able to keep his heart going for 30 minutes and get him stable enough that we felt, okay, let's get him in the airplane and let's go. So that's what we did. We threw him in the airplane, and we just flew as fast as we could back to the University Burn Center. That was one of the longest 1.5-hour flights I think I've ever been on. And it was a thunderstorm, so it was not fun flying. It was bouncy. I thought Bradley had died. I estimated him with 70% third-degree burns, and every inch and rest of his body had first or second-degree burns. There wasn't a spot on this child's body that was not burned. Okay, and at 70% third-degree, it's fatal. So 12 weeks later, when I got called to go up to the burn ICU, I was sort of, okay, whatever. But I was told Bradley wanted to talk to me. And I was absolutely stunned that he was still alive. But I went in, and holy cow, he gave me a hug. And then he patted the bed to him and said, sit down. This kid's 6.5 years old. Patted the bed, sit down. We have to talk. And I thought, oh dear. Oh my. So here's his experience that he relayed to me. He said that when I put him to sleep, he did indeed. He left his body and he floated up to the ceiling. He described what I did to him from that point onward with 100% accuracy, even for a six-year-old. It was stunning. He talked about the defibrillator. He described it. He talked about the central lines, the cutting of the skin. He talked about absolutely everything. Then he told me he could hear what I was thinking. And I thought, oh, no. But he said he could hear how worried and scared I was that I wasn't going to be able to keep him alive. And then he said, Father wanted me to tell you that he knows you swear far too much. He then said that he went through a very nice, beautiful, peaceful tunnel and went out into a sky filled with clouds. He was met by his great uncle. His great uncle had died at the age of 8, so they were almost the same age. He said there were a few angels watching over him, and he said, sort of like our babysitters. He was not happy at babysitters. The two boys played hide and seek in those clouds. Bradley then tried to describe for me what the clouds felt like, what they smelled like, and he said they smelled really, really sweet, like cotton candy sweet. How fun they were to play in. He just went on for a long time describing clouds and the consistency of it and how wonderful it was. Then when playtime was over, their babysitter angels took them into a very beautiful garden type of a park. He described that it was really, really big and had all these really pretty flowers. He tried to describe for me how the flowers and trees were alive, had feelings, and sang to you. He, in his vocabulary at 6 years of age, he did have a lot of trouble as he tried to describe these things because, frankly, those of you who have had experiences of your own know how difficult it is to articulate something that has no way in the English language to articulate. But he did a great job trying. He said there were people standing around and sitting, relaxing. He said it was so, so peaceful. Everyone was wearing the most beautiful white robes. And he tried to describe the material as silky, shiny, glittery, and he couldn't come up with really what it was. He was led over to a specific group of people, and he recognized them absolutely immediately. It was Heaven Father and Heaven Mother. Father was sitting on the stone bench. Mother was lounging on the grass next to the bench, and his new best friend, which was his dead uncle, sat next to her on the grass. Brother Jesus was standing by the bench, next to Mother. Bradley climbed up into Heaven Father's lap, and Father gave me the biggest bear hug. He said he described the amount of love as huge amount of love, surrounding him and going right through him when Father hugged him. He started to tear up when he told me that, and he started to cry. Bradley then told me that Heaven Father and Brother Jesus decided to have a joke-telling contest. Now, Bradley told me the jokes, and I went and wrote them down, and in my many moves, I have lost the joke. But I can remember how absolutely hilarious. I mean, I just laughed and laughed and laughed when Bradley told them to me. And he tried to imitate the belly laugh of Heaven Father. Now, you think of this poor kid with all the Job stockings, right? He put his hands on his little belly, and he started to laugh like Santa Claus. And he tried really hard to laugh, and it hurt him to laugh, but he really wanted me to know how Heaven Father sounded when he laughed. Bradley then described to me how absolutely beautiful Heaven Mother is, how loving and beautiful. He spent about 15 minutes on this, and he had such difficulty describing Heaven Mother and the love that she radiated and the beauty that she had. But he wanted me to know so bad. Bradley was having the most wonderful time. He never, never, never wanted to leave. But Heaven Father told him he needed to go back because he was not finished yet. Bradley began to beg him not to send him away. It was just too painful, and he didn't want to go back. And Bradley said, he pleaded and pleaded like you do with your earth parents to get your way, only it doesn't work with Heaven Father. But he said he really tried hard. We just laughed at that. Heaven Father told him that he had a special job for him to do and that he would help him through the pain and suffering that he would experience. Then Heaven Father looked him right in the eye and said, you go to Janet and you tell her that she swears too much. Don't forget. I've tried hard to curb that problem, but it's still a problem. So Brother Jesus then took his hand and walked him back to his body. He woke up many weeks later in the burn unit. He did code, they told me, about 6 times in the burn unit. And he did try really hard to die. But the Lord had a mission for him, so he was going to survive. One last experience to tell you. And this is more of an experience that I had flying, and it was more of an example of how we listen and receive direction to help us in our everyday lives. Tommy was a 10-year-old child who was out snowmobiling with his dad, several other friends, and their dad. Again, on a snowmobile trip to central Utah. His dad took a jump really, really fast, not realizing that he was jumping that snowmobile right in the side of a cement bridge. Tommy was sitting in the front. The dad was in the back driving the snowmobile. Okay, so they took it really fast and took the jump and right into the bridge, which threw the dad head first into the bridge. And Tommy must have hit the bridge but was thrown over into a snowbank. Everybody went to the dad, who was laying really, really still. Nobody looked at Tommy. They forgot. He was awake, alert. Okay, nobody noticed how still he was sitting. So we flew the helicopter down to help out. We arrived, went over, checked the dad, and I pronounced him dead at the scene. There was nothing that was going to be done. Then I found out at that point that Tommy was riding in the front of that snowmobile. And I looked over to where he was and saw how still and how pale he was sitting there, just with the glazed eyes, just sitting there in the snowbank. And that is a bad sign. Bad. So started working on him. I found the imprint of the speedometer in his chest. I could read the numbers in his chest. He had broken his sternum. He had broken and crushed part of his chest. And he had no breath sounds. So I knew he had a collapsed lung at the bare minimum. And I knew I had to put chest tubes in. But we were in trouble, so I just said, let's just do it in flight. It was an hour flight. So we threw him in the back of the helicopter, and we took off for Primary Children's. So we laid everything out to put the chest tube in. And I picked the scalpel up to go start cutting the chest to put this tube in. And in my headset, you know, you wear headsets in the helicopters, right, with the mic? So in my headset, I heard, do not place the chest tube. And I looked up at my paramedic and I said, why not? And he looked at me like, what? What? And he said, I didn't say anything. And he went back to doing what he was doing. So I thought I was maybe losing my mind, and I picked the scalpel up and I was going to slice that chest and do it again. And I heard very loudly in my headset, do not put that chest tube in. I looked at my paramedic again. He was busy. He wasn't paying attention. He obviously hadn't heard a word. So I took a deep breath and thought, okay, Lord, I get it. And I didn't put the chest tube in. And my paramedic said, well, aren't you going to get it in? I said, you know what? I've changed my mind. I think he's stable. Let's just leave well enough alone. Let's just watch him. Say, you know? So we get to the trauma center at Primary Children's, and I took an absolute tongue lashing from the trauma team for not putting the chest tube in. I was an idiot, I was an imbecile, I was incompetent. They went on and on and on. And I just said, thank you very much. She has a blood pressure and a pulse, and they're stable. And I walked out the door. So they took him to the OR and went to put the chest tube in, at which moment he hemorrhaged to death. He coded on the OR table. Took him 3 minutes to bleed out in his chest. Now, he was in the OR, so they could crack his chest and get him back. He had severed his pulmonary artery. Had I done that procedure in the helicopter, he would have died in flight, and I would not have been able to save him. And it was only because of guardian angels that were watching over him that I listened and didn't put that tube in him. What I wanted just quickly to review is there are people that have had experiences here. There are people that are spouses or friends or people who are affiliated with them. So I have come across a lot of things over these 40 years, and I just wanted to review them real quick. And these are aimed more for not the experiencer, but for the people that love them and care for them. Sometimes people that have a near-death experience really question their sanity. I know after my own personal one, I did. And I know a lot of my patients do. Survivors come to love and accept others without the usual attachment. So they become huggy, they love everybody, they strangers they'll hug. You can imagine the jealousy and the angst that this causes a spouse who doesn't understand it, or others that are witnessing this changed personality, this hugging, loving type, and it can drive people crazy. And it's one of the factors that lead to divorce. I don't know if you know this, but near-death survivors, there's greater than the 75% divorce rate. Were you aware of that? Greater than 75% divorce rate. So these are some of the reasons that lead to that. These people sometimes come back and they have a hard time understanding boundaries, hard time understanding rules, limits. It can be a real problem. They don't understand time or schedules. They stop wearing watches, a lot of them. And so if you say, hey, we got to go to X, Y, and Z at 3 o'clock, they may or may not show up. It might be 4 o'clock. It could be 6 o'clock. They have no concept of time, okay? It's really, really hard. I had a best friend who had been through one, and I started telling her 2 hours early, we're going to leave at 1, so that she'd be ready by 3. They usually come back with accentuated gifts, spiritual gifts, intuitiveness, see auras. They can hear the other side, dream awareness. Oh, my gosh, the list is so long. And I bet you if we took a poll here of near-death experience folks, everybody would have a new gift that they had come back with. A lot of them absolutely have no fear of death. Of the survivors, how many of you are willing to raise your hand and say, I absolutely have no fear of death? Bring it on. Been there, done that. There's just no fear. And so because of that, sometimes they can become a little risk-taking, and that can lead to some angst in their families. Men become more thoughtful, caring, and emotionally expressive. That poor wife. Well, she's not used to that. She might be going, oh, yeah, thank you, but she's got to get used to it. Women become more assertive and outspoken. Ooh, that could lead to some problems, couldn't it? A lot of family members and friends will put these people up on a pedestal, and they'll expect these unrealistic expectations from them. And then they're very, very angry and disappointed when that person can't live up to their expectations. Many are depressed. It took me 3 years to get over my depression, but many people come back very, 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 very depressed. It is the hardest thing a person will ever do to come back to this horrible, painful, dark world after what you've experienced. So be cognizant of that. Be aware of that. They are going to suffer depression, so just help them through that. Some people have a hard time with religious beliefs because sometimes it doesn't reconcile with what they've been taught. I had a Muslim who was telling me all about their experience and told me that they had left Islam and had converted to Christianity because it was Jesus Christ who had gone through their life review with them. But it didn't jive with his Islamic faith. There wasn't 72 virgins waiting for him. I'm not dissing, but he was really upset about this. Some people come back with an absolute new thirst, just a thirst for knowledge and hunger. I know I did. You can't read enough, study enough, learn enough. You want to learn everything. So those are some things that we can do. And now I just wanted to go over one thing. Some of you older folks, do you remember Don Woods? Don Woods was a fabulous friend of mine who had actually had 4 near-death experiences. He wrote up what he called the lessons of life. And I got these. And over now 40-year span, these have held true. My patients have said these things, so I want to relay them to you because they're just astounding. The first one is there is a supreme being. He is a real person. He knows you individually, by name, and he loves you very, very much. Two, God loves everyone. Literally everyone. Whether you do or not, he does. It doesn't matter what race, gender, life occupation, yearly salary, religion. And we're here to learn to love as God loves. Three, you will learn lessons. You're enrolled in a full-time and formal school called Life. Each day in this school, you have the opportunity to learn lessons. You may like the lessons or you may think they're disgusting, stupid, or hard. Nevertheless, you will experience them. You chose them before you came to Earth. We chose what we get to experience and go through. The me now is saying, what was the me then thinking? Four, there are no failures, only lessons. A lesson will be presented to you in various forms over and over and over again until you've learned it. When you've learned it and master it, you get to go on to the next lesson. Five, a lesson is repeated over and over until you've learned and mastered it. He says this twice because he really wants you to understand this concept. Six, learning lessons never ends. Ooh, doesn't matter how old we get. We still get to learn lessons. There's no part or time of life that does not contain its lesson. If you are alive and breathing, you have lessons to learn. Seven, others are merely a mirror of you. If you cannot love or hate something about another person, unless it reflects something from you. If you hate something about somebody, look at yourself because you're hating something that you have within you. Okay? Eight, what you make of your life is strictly up to you. You have all the tools and resources you need. The choice is yours. All yours. Nobody else. It's all yours. Nine, all your answers lie within you. All the answers lie within you. 10, there are absolutely no accidents. There are no coincidences. There are no accidents. You are accountable and responsible for everything you choose, whether it be a good choice or a bad choice. You're responsible for it, and you will pay the consequences for that choice. You might be tempted to assign your accountability to someone else or something else. I know I'm pretty guilty of this. But in the end of the day, you are ultimately responsible. And number 11 was, you're going to forget it all. So that's all the experiences I had. I didn't want to bore you, overwhelm you. Do we have any questions?
When you first started talking to us, you said that lady motioned you over and you sat down and she wasn't going to be allowed to go home until she talked to you. What was it that she had to say to you? I mean, there must have been some purpose in it, unless it's too personal.
She wanted me to know that she had had a near-death experience. Because I guess the Lord knew that once I heard that, I would start studying and learning and researching. What is this near-death experience?
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Two questions. One is, roughly about how many different near-death experiences have you heard about? I realize you haven't been recording them, as you said. And two, you mentioned you had had two experiences yourself. Did those come before or after you started learning and researching into NDEs?
I stopped recording at 1,500 patients. I've had one near-death experience myself. And it came, let's see, I had that lady tell me about it in 83, and I had mine in 87. So I had been an ICU nurse for 9 years. I'd heard a lot.
So it wasn't a surprise to you?
No, not at all. I knew exactly what was going on.
Nowadays, if someone is sick and they have something that and they're older and they can't cure them, they will give them the option of taking morphine and going into a coma until their body shuts down. And I'm wondering, if that person dies in that coma, how is their brain after death? Because they're not conscious, they're in a coma. And I'm just wondering about that transition.
Yeah, I've never been there. I wouldn't know. Actually, when you make the decision that you don't want anything else done, they don't just gork you up and put you in a coma. They send you home with pain relief, and you slide into a coma on your own. I've been told by those that have come back that their brain is very aware, but not on this plane. Their brain is very aware of the people that are there to pick them up. They have conversations, but they're really not aware of what's happening on this plane. But it's rare that somebody's ever come back and said, this is what happens. So it's hard to say, this is what we know happens. Does that make sense?
Did I hear you say there are no failures, only lessons?
Yes.
So no one is ultimately a failure, but some people have a lot longer path.
Some people have to repeat that lesson a whole lot of times.
To tread than others do. Is Heavenly Father's love unconditional regardless of what religion we choose on this plane?
From what I'm hearing from my patients, his love is unconditional. He might be mightily disappointed in your choices, but his love of you is unconditional.
You mentioned one of the characteristics that most people experience is they come back with a gift of some sort. Did you come back with a gift like that?
Am I going to expound on it? No. But yes, I did.
Would you mind sharing a bit about your experience?
In 1987, back in the olden days, they do what's called a VBAC. So after you've had a cesarean section, they try to make you go through labor and deliver vaginally as an experiment. That was what they used to do. But people like me statistically stop that practice, okay? I was VBACing with my second child. They're only 14 months apart. You know, that flu that doesn't go away, number one. And, oh, my gosh, I got the flu again, number two. I was never supposed to have kids. I was infertile. So when I got the flu that wouldn't go away, it was surprising that it was actually a baby. So I had him, cesarean section, and all of a sudden I had the flu again. And even more surprised that it was a baby. And the doctor's going, do I have to explain how this works? But anyway, I went into labor with him. 10 hours went through, and I was fully dilated, and I was pushing, you know. Pushed for 3 hours. Baby was acidotic. They kept doing blood gases on the baby, and baby's in distress, kept having decelerations. And if you're labor and delivery people, you know these are all bad signs. For the last half of my labor, I knew I was going to die. Had anybody ever spent enough time to say, Janet, what's going on? I would have said, I'm going to die. I knew it. I knew it. And I didn't care because I was in so much pain. So when I ruptured my uterus and started bleeding to death, they raced me down to the operating room from the labor room. I knew that my time was very limited, and I just cannot describe the pain to you. The pain was so overwhelming. It was truly indescribable. The baby's heart had stopped. We knew the baby had died. And I could hear him calling the code on the baby. And I can remember looking up at the anesthesia machine and seeing my blood pressure at 50 systolic and my heart rate at about 180, 190. And I thought to myself, hang in there another minute or two and you'll be dead and it'll be all good. Isn't that crazy? But I knew it. I knew it. So the next thing I know, I'm out of my body. It was just like in less than a heartbeat. And I'm up here by the right-hand side of my shoulder looking down, I could see the Mayo stand with all the tools, and they slashed, they didn't even prep, so I could see a little bit of blood over there, and I could see the code, the baby warmer. But right here in front of me was crystal clear, and everything to the side got wider and wider into the most brilliant white that you would think it would scorch your retina, and the walls just faded into that, to the light. And so I was watching this code going on, and I got really, really bored. I'm me up here. And so the first thoughts I had as I popped out was, number one, oh, I can breathe. And two, there's no pain. I'm free. There's no pain. Oh, I can't tell you how wonderful that was. It was so glorious. But as I stood there and watched this code and how boring it was, I realized that the reason everything in front of me was so crystal clear was because I was blocking the light from somebody behind me. And I kind of knew who it was, and I was unsure at first if I wanted to turn around and look. But I did. And a lot of this was blocked from me for the longest time, but over time I've gotten a lot back. So I turned around and I looked, and it was Jesus Christ standing there with the biggest smile on his face. So it was my time to go. I had completed what I had contracted to do. My mission was finished. He said, but. And you know, whenever the Lord says, but, you know that's a really big deal. And he said, I have another mission if you choose to do it. And let me tell you, informed consent has a whole new meaning. Okay? So not only do you see it, feel it, and see it, and hear it, and oh my goodness. So he showed me what the mission would be, and if I chose to accept it, and I obviously I did, how do you tell the Lord no? I mean, seriously, really? So I said, well, of course I will do anything for you. He said, everything would be taken from me. My memory would be taken. I would only remember the gist of what it was, but all the detail would be taken. But in time, I would recognize the road posts when they showed up and understand them for what it was. I woke up about 12 hours later, tied down. I was intubated. You know, I'm testing. I'm in so much pain. And finally, when I could move enough, I came up and pulled everything out. I was in my own ICU unit. Go figure. What was my mission? So my mission has twofold. It was to take care of that child that they resuscitated that had died in utero. They resuscitated him. I mean, he's now 31 years old. And it's to help him some way. And now I'm kind of getting an idea what that is. The second was to help emotionally, physically, psychologically, and spiritually the women and the children who are going to be suffering through the end time tribulations. And my whole career in life has been focused on being able to fulfill that mission. Have I seen the road post? Oh, yeah. Has my mission started? Yes. Is what he showed me happening? The answer is yes. And that's pretty much it that I remember.
I'm just wondering, when you hesitated to turn around, if you were afraid that he might ask you about your language.
Well, actually that was before. That was before Bradley. Okay. But I did swear back then, too.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
People that have these experiences apparently come back with a very calm assurance that there is a life hereafter. However, have you ever heard of anyone that came back that committed suicide?
Yes.
Apparently a rare occasion?
Really rare. And it was because they couldn't get through the depression of having to come back. This isn't a very nice place. When you've been to the other side, this is dark and dreary and mean and not nice. And so that's why everybody goes through a depression.
In Utah, probably more than any other state, there's a lot of suicides among young people. Is it possible there's some venue or some way that this kind of message could be presented or taught the young people in maybe a non-religious context? Would that be of any benefit? If this has a high rate of confidence, there is a hereafter and perhaps a low percentage of suicide.
I used to speak to a lot of high school groups in Alabama and Pennsylvania. I did a lot of speaking in the East Coast. Right now, there's a peer pressure fad amongst the young to commit suicide. The problem is that the kids who think they're invincible don't realize it's permanent. So I don't know. I mean, is there a need for it? Well, possibly. Is there a venue set up? Not that I'm aware of. Could ions create something? Possibly. Would it help? I would hope so, but I don't think it's ever been done before, so I don't know.
I guess the first thing I want to just express is just my appreciation and gratitude for you coming tonight and for your beautiful presentation. And I don't... Yeah, it was very, 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 very wonderful. And the second thing I just want to share is my deep gratitude and appreciation for your service as a nurse. In 2001, my husband was burned, over 98% of his body, and he was in the burn center, and I have three daughters. Because of the care of those nurses that were on duty, it just impressed me and it impressed my children greatly. They just carried the same compassion and beautiful energy that was presented here tonight, and just how lucky those that you serve are, and that the stories that you shared tonight were just absolutely very inspiring and touching and beautiful. And thank you so much, Janet.
You're most welcome.
Thank you.
You're in nursing, which is medical science. Science is very materialistic and mechanical in nature. The NDEs, many of them say that everything is alive. It's the first time I've heard that the sky is alive and has feelings. We've heard before about the flowers have feelings and they sing. Do you have any further insights about that contrast between science, the mechanics, and the unprovable, etherical, non-tangible living, that maybe Earth is not just minerals, but it's an organic?
I don't think that will ever be reconciled in our time and age. We all know that things vibrate at different frequencies. I mean, that's proven. But how do you prove something that's unprovable? People that don't believe in it generally will never believe in it till they've experienced it themselves. Doctors on a whole will deny it, but if you talk to them individually, they'll embrace it and say, oh yeah, I believe it. I don't know how you'd reconcile the science materialistic piece with the spiritual ethereal piece. I just don't think it's possible at this point in our understanding.
I've been pondering a question for a long time, and I've been sitting here thinking maybe you've had enough experience to be able to comment on it. When people die, having read a few of these experiences, I realized that they are given the option to let go and die at a certain time. As far as you know, is that ability to let go and pass over something that is that completely the decision of the person who's passing? Or are they restricted from dying? A way to say it another way is, if they're experiencing pain, are they required to experience a certain amount of pain before they're invited to cross over? Or can they just choose, like, oh, I have a headache tonight, I guess I'll cross over now? What do you know about that?
If it's not your time, it doesn't matter how bad you want to go, you're not going.
Perhaps that's part of the agreements that you made or decisions you made before you were born.
Definitely. Now, some people have no choice. They're taken, it's their time, done. Other people that I've experienced in the ICU, they will linger and linger and linger and linger until the family's been able to say, it's okay, we're done, we're going to let you go. And then they go. And they linger to give the family enough time to say goodbye and come to grips with them dying. Other linger and linger and linger until the family leaves, because they don't want to die while the family's there. As soon as the family goes down the hall, they pass on. But no, I don't believe everybody has the choice of when to go. I think it's sort of predetermined.
Is it true that some people, like, they'll be really, really sick, and then all of a sudden they'll seem like they're getting better,
just so people can gather and then they'll die the next. I mean, I've just heard that a few times, like they'll suddenly you'll think they're getting better and, oh, they're going to have a turnaround and then the next day they die. Is that something you've experienced?
All the time. Even comatose people sometimes will have a couple hours of lucidity and then they're gone. Not everybody, but some do, yes.
Thank you for sharing. I can understand why you might have been reluctant to share your own experience, so thank you for that. That sounds glorious and grievous at the same time. Did your child make it?
Yeah.
Okay.
31 and a brat.
Great. Wonderful. Wonderful. And apparently, at some point, you became very open-minded to, even before your own experience, to see that this was a real phenomenon or whatever. And I think it takes an open mind to be able to let that in. And given what it sounds like you feel like your kind of mission or is now, how do you feel about that and that people are told to speak to you by name?
It's happened like so often now that it doesn't give me goosebumps. I'm excited about my mission that has started. I'm really excited. I'm not surprised anymore when people come and say, I have to tell you something. I'm okay with it. I'm a really good listener. And sometimes I can help them sort it all out and come to grips with it and understand what's happened. But yeah, it's just happened so many times over these years that nothing surprises me anymore.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And forgive me for sticking this in here. Do you experience burnout at all, or is critical care nursing just kind of second nature to you, like the back of your hand?
Critical care nursing was a calling, I believe, that I accepted before I ever came to this earth. So I have not experienced burnout. I have been supported. Yes, ICU nurses, ER nurses, especially helicopter nurses, burn out very quickly. The things that we see and deal, no human being should have to see and deal with. But for some reason, it's like I got a compartment and a switch in here that I can turn on and off. I've just been supported, and I really feel strongly that it was a calling that I accepted before I came.